unfashionably late. I don't even bother pulling into Kent's driveway. I'm not planning on being here long, and I don't want to get blocked in. Besides, something about tramping through the woods in the rain appeals to me. It's a trial, another way I can sacrifice myself. And from my very limited memories of Sunday school, my mom gave up the fight after I threw a tremendous tantrum when I was 7 and threatened to convert to voodoo, even though I wasn't sure exactly what that was. I know that that's how it works. You have to sacrifice something. I pull over onto the shoulder of Route 9, grabbing Izzy's sweatshirt again, which is now soaking wet. Still, it's better than nothing. I drape it over my head and get out of the car, pausing for just a second. The road is empty, stretches of black interspersed with weak pools of yellow light from the street lamps. I try to locate the exact spot where Lindsay's car went spiraling off the road that first night, but it all looks the same. It could have been anywhere. I reach back once more for some memory of life beyond the collision, beyond the blackness, but I get nothing. I grab a flashlight from the trunk and set off through the woods. It's a longer walk than I would have thought, and the ground alternates between a thin coat of hard ice and slurpy gloop that sucks at my purple New Balances like quicksand. After a few minutes, I can hear the faint throb of music from the party pulsing through the darkness like it belongs there, like its rhythm is part of the night. It's another 10 minutes before I see the faint twinkle of lights flashing sporadically beyond the trees. Thank God, since I was beginning to think I was walking in circles. And another 5 before the woods thin out and I can see the house. A big pile of ice cream cake sitting on that lawn, shimmering in and out as the rain bends and splits the lights from the porch. I'm totally freezing and 100% regretting my decision to come on foot. That's the whole problem with sacrifice. It's a pain. Literally. As soon as I walk through the door, 2 girls giggle and a whole group of juniors goes totally gape-jawed. I don't blame them. I know I must look like shit. Before leaving the house, I didn't even bother to change out of my lounge pants, a pair of way oversized velour sweats my mom gave me back when they were still in. I don't waste any time on the juniors, though. I'm already worried I may have arrived too late. Tara is coming down the stairs as I'm pushing my way up, and I grab her, leaning into her ear. Juliet Sykes! I have to yell it. What? She yells back, smiling. Juliet Sykes, is she here? Tara taps her ear to show she can't hear me. You're looking for Lindsay? Courtney is behind Tara and leans forward, flopping her chin on Tara's shoulder. We found the secret stash. Rum and stuff. Tara broke a vase. She giggles. You want some? I shake my head. I've never been this sober around people this wasted, and I say a brief prayer that I'm not half as annoying as they are when I'm drunk. I continue up the stairs as Tara yells, Lindsay's in the back! Before I'm totally out of earshot, I hear Courtney shriek, Did you see what she's wearing? I take a deep breath and tell myself it doesn't matter. What matters is finding Juliet. I can at least do that one thing. But with every step, I'm losing hope. The upstairs hallway is totally packed, and unless she hasn't come to the party at all, which seems like too much to hope, it seems unlikely that she hasn't already left. Still, I push on, finally making it to the very back room. Lindsay catapults on me as soon as I get into the room. She actually leaps over 5 people, and for a second, I'm so grateful to see her. Happy and drunk and my best friend, and to get treated to one of her famous super squish hugs, that I forget why I'm here. Bad girl. She slaps my hand as she pulls away. You cut school but come out to party? Naughty, naughty. I'm looking for someone, I say. I scan the room. Juliet's not here, not that I expected her to be, I don't know, sitting on the couch and chatting it up with Jake Summers, but it's instinct and wishful thinking to look. Rob's downstairs. Lindsay steps back and holds up her hand, framing me in the angle between her thumb and forefinger. You look like the homeless man who stole Walmart. Are you trying not to get laid or something? Irritation flares up again. Lindsay, who always has something to say. Have you seen Juliet Sykes? I ask. Lindsay stares at me for a split second and then bursts out laughing. Are you serious? A feeling of enormous relief washes over me. Maybe she never showed. Maybe she had car trouble or lost her nerve or... She called me a bitch. In that moment, Lindsay shatters me. She did come. Can you believe it? Lindsay's still cracking up. She loops one arm around my shoulder and calls out, Elodie! Allie! Sammy's here, and she's looking for her best friend, Juliet. Elodie doesn't even turn around. She's too busy with Steve Doe. But Allie swings in my direction, smiles, yells, Hi, sweetie! And then holds up the empty bottle of vodka. If you see Juliet, she calls out, ask her what she did with the rest of my drink. She and Lindsay think this is hilarious, and Lindsay calls back, Psycho teeny. I am too late. The realization makes me feel sick, and my anger at Lindsay comes rushing back. My best friend? I repeat, that's funny. I thought you were the one who was buddy-buddy with Juliet. What are you talking about? Lindsay's face gets serious. Childhood friends? Best friends? Rugrats? Sand bunnies? Lindsay looks like she's about to say something again, but I cut her off. I saw the pictures. So what happened? Did she catch you farting or something? See you blow a snot rocket? Discover that the famous Lindsay Edgecomb isn't perfect after all? What did she do that was so bad? Lindsay opens her mouth and then closes it. She's a freak, she whispers fiercely. But I see something in her eyes I've never seen before, an expression I can't quite identify. Whatever. I have to find Juliet Sykes. I fight my way back downstairs, ignoring the people calling my name, tapping my shoulder and whispering about the fact that I've shown up in public looking like I'm about to go to sleep, which is, of course, exactly what happened. I figure if I'm quick enough, I can catch Juliet on the way out. She must have parked somewhere. She's probably blocked in. It will take an hour to get people to move their cars, if she can even convince anybody to help at all, which is doubtful. And even longer if she decides to hoof it home. Thankfully, I make it downstairs without a run-in with Rob. The last thing I need is to explain myself to him. There's a group of sophomores standing near the entryway looking terrified and more or less sober, so I take my shot with them. Have you seen Juliet Sykes? They stare at me blankly. I sigh, swallowing my frustration. Blonde hair, blue eyes, tall... They're still looking at me vacantly, and I realize I'm not exactly sure how to describe her. Loser, I almost say. I would have said 3 days ago, but now I can't get it out. Pretty, I say, testing the word. When that doesn't work, I squeeze my fists into my palms. Probably soaking wet? Finally, the girls' faces light up with recognition. Bathroom, one of them says, pointing to a little alcove just before the kitchen. There's a line of people gathered in front of a closed door. One of them is crossing her legs and hopping up and down. One of them keeps rapping on the door. One of them points to her watch and says something I can't hear, but she looks pissed. She's been in there for like 20 minutes, a sophomore says. My stomach drops to my feet and I almost get sick right there. Bathrooms have pills. Bathrooms have razors. People lock themselves in bathrooms when they want to do bad things like have sex or throw up or kill themselves. It's not supposed to go this way. I'm supposed to save you. I elbow over to the bathroom, shoving through the line of people crowded there. Move, I say to Joanne Palermo, and she drops her hand immediately and steps aside. I press my ear to the door, listening for sounds of crying or retching or anything. Nothing. My stomach does another dip. Then again, it's almost impossible to hear with the music pounding so loudly. I knock softly and call out, Juliet, are you okay? Maybe she's sleeping, Chrissy Walker says. I shoot her a look that I hope will communicate how stupidly unhelpful that comment is. I knock again, mashing my face against the door. It's hard to tell whether I hear a faint moan from inside. At that second, the music shrieks even louder, drowning out everything else. But I can imagine her there, fading just beyond the door, wrists hacked up and blood everywhere. Get Kent, I say, sucking in a long breath.
Who?
Joanne says.
I have to pee,
Rachel says, hopping up and down.
Kent McFuller, now, do it.
I bark at Joanne, and she looks startled but scurries off into the hallway. Every second feels like an eternity. It's the first time I really understand what Einstein said about relativity, how time bends around and stretches out like a gummy bear.
Why do you care anyway?
Rachel says, grumbling just loud enough so I can hear. I don't answer. The truth is, I have no answer, really. I have to save Juliet. I feel that. It's my good thing. I have to save myself. I'm suddenly not sure if that makes me better or worse than someone who does nothing, so I push the thought out of my mind. Joanne comes back with Kent in tow. He looks worried, his forehead crinkly underneath the shaggy brown hair that's falling down over his eyes. My stomach does a flip. Yesterday we were in a dark room no more than 2 inches apart, so close I could feel the amazing heat of his skin.
Sam?
He says, and leans forward to grab my wrist, staring deep in my eyes.
Are you okay?
I'm so surprised by the sudden touch. I pull away just a fraction, and Kent takes back his hand. I don't know how to explain the way this makes my insides go hollow. I'm fine, I say, totally aware in that moment of how ridiculous I must look to him. The messed up hair, the sweatpants. He, by comparison, looks actually kind of put together. There's something scruffy cute about his checkered sneakers and loose, low-belted khakis, and the sleeves of his Oxford are rolled up, showing off a tan he got God knows where, certainly not in Ridgeview in the past 6 months. He looks confused.
Joanne said you needed me?
I do need you. It comes out weird and intense sounding, and I feel a furious fit of blushing coming on. I mean, I don't need you, I just need... I take a deep breath. I think I see a momentary spark in Kent's eyes and it distracts me. I'm worried Juliet Sykes is locked in the bathroom. Just after I say it, I wince. I sound ridiculous. He'll probably tell me I'm being insane. After all, he doesn't know what I know. The spark dies and his face gets serious. He steps beyond me and tries the door. Then he pauses for a second, thinking. He doesn't tell me I'm crazy or paranoid or anything. He simply says,
There's no key. I could try to pick the lock. We can always break it open if we have to.
I'm going to pee upstairs,
Rachel announces, then turns on her heel and wobbles off. Kent reaches in his back pocket and pulls out a handful of safety pins.
Don't ask,
he says when I raise my eyebrows. I hold up my hands and don't push the issue. I'm grateful he's taking charge without asking questions. He squats down, bends the safety pin backward, and uses it to jimmy the lock. He's keeping his ear pressed to the door like he's listening for a click. Finally, my curiosity gets the better of me. Do you have an after-school job robbing banks or something? He grimaces, tries the door, slips the safety pin back in his pocket, and selects a credit card from his wallet.
Hardly.
He wedges the credit card in the crevice between the frame and the door and wiggles.
My mom used to keep the junk food locked behind our pantry door.
He straightens up and twists the handle. The door opens an inch and my heart flies up into my throat. Part of me is hoping that Juliet's face will appear furious or that the door will be slammed closed again from inside. That's what I would do if someone tried to open the bathroom door when I was inside. That is, if I was still awake, alive, to close it. But the door just sits there, open that little inch. Kent and I just look at each other at first. I think we're both scared to open it any farther. Then Kent nudges the door with his toe, calling,
Juliet?
As the door swings open, again, time stretches. It seems to take forever, and in that second or half second, I somehow have the time to conjure up every horrible possibility, to imagine her body crumpled on the ground. And then the door finishes swinging, and the bathroom is there, perfectly clean, perfectly normal, and perfectly empty. The lights are on, and there's a damp hand towel draped over the sink. The only thing slightly out of the ordinary is the window. It's wide open, and rain has been battering in onto the tiles below.
She went out the window,
Kent says at the same time I'm thinking it. I can't quite place his tone. It's half sad, half admiring. Shit. Of course. After a humiliation like that, she would have looked for the easiest escape possible, the one that would attract the least attention. The window looks out onto a sloping side lawn and, of course, the woods. She must have made a dash for it, planning to loop around back toward the driveway. I hurtle out of the bathroom. Kent calls, "Wait!" But I'm already down the hall and out the door, pushing onto the porch. I grab my flashlight and the sweatshirt from behind a planter where I'd left them and head out across the lawn. The rain isn't so bad just at the moment, more of a freezing mist falling in solid layers from above, but it's the kind of cold that goes right through you. I keep my flashlight trained on the ground as I sweep around to the side of the house. I'm not exactly a master tracker, but I've read enough old mysteries to know that you should always look for footprints. Unfortunately, the mud is so gross and damp that everything looks churned up. Still, at the base of the bathroom, I find a deep indent where she must have landed and a series of scuffly-looking marks going, as I suspected, straight to the woods. I wrap my sweatshirt more tightly around me and plunge in after her. I can't see anything but a few feet of light extending in a bouncing circle in front of me. I've never been scared of the dark exactly, but the endless scrapings and groanings of the trees and the constant patter of rain through the branches make it sound like the woods are alive and babbling away, like one of those crazy people you see in New York City who are always pushing grocery carts filled with empty bags. There's no point in trying to follow Juliet's footprints. They're totally invisible in the soggy paste of decaying leaves, mud, and rotting bark. Instead, I strike out in what I hope is the general direction of the road, hoping to catch her on her walk home. I'm pretty sure this is what she intends to do. If you're so desperate to ditch a party and the people in it that you climb out a window, it's hardly likely that you'll stroll back minutes later and ask people to move their Hondas. The rain starts coming down harder, rattling through the icy branches, the sound of bone on bone. My chest aches from the cold, and even though I'm moving as fast as I can, my fingers feel numb and I'm having trouble holding onto the flashlight. I can't wait to get to my car and turn the heat on full blast. Then I'll drive the streets looking for her. If worse comes to worse, I'll intercept her at her house. If only I make it out of these freaking woods. I push myself forward even faster, half jogging now, trying to stay warm. Every few moments I call out, "Juliet!" But I don't expect to get an answer. The patter of the rain is getting heavier and more constant, big, fat drops of it splashing on the back of my neck and making me gasp. "Juliet! Juliet!" The patter turns into a rush. Daggers of icy water slice into me. I keep up the jog, the flashlight like lead in my hand. I can't feel my toes anymore. I don't even know if I'm going in the right direction. I could be running around in circles for all I know. "Juliet!" I start to get scared. I turn a full circle, sweeping my flashlight through the darkness. Nothing but dense trees pressing in on either side of me. It didn't take me this long to walk through the woods on the way to Kent's. I'm sure of it. My fingers feel like they're twice the size they should be, and as I'm spinning, the flashlight flies out of my hand. There's a crash and the sound of splintering. The light sputters and dies, and I'm left totally in darkness. Shit, 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 shit! Cursing out loud makes me feel better. I take a few hesitant steps in the direction of the flashlight, keeping my arms out in front of me so I don't collide with anything. After a few shuffling steps, I drop to my knees, instantly destroying my house pants as wetness seeps through the fabric. I rake my hands in the sludge in front of me, trying hard not to think too much about what I'm touching. Rain is driving into my eyes, my fleece is clinging to my skin, and it smells like wet dog. I'm shivering uncontrollably. This is what happens when you try to help people. You get screwed. I feel a lump building in my throat. In order to keep from a total meltdown, I think about what Lindsay would say if she were stuck with me in the middle of the night, in the middle of woods that extend who knows how many miles in the middle of a monsoon. If she saw me tearing at the ground like a deranged mole completely covered in mud.
"Samantha Kingston," she would say, smiling.
I always knew deep down you were a very dirty girl.
The thought only cheers me up for a second. Lindsay's not here with me. Lindsay's probably making out with Patrick in a toasty, warm, and very dry room right now, or passing a joint back and forth and wondering out loud to Allie why I've been acting so freaktastic. I am completely lost, completely miserable, and completely alone. The ache in my throat intensifies until I feel like there's an animal trying to claw its way out of my throat. And I am suddenly angry at Juliet. So angry, I could punch her. I don't see how she can be so selfish. No matter what, no matter how bad things are, she has a choice. Not all of us are so lucky. That's when I hear the most beautiful sound I've ever heard in the entirety of my 17 years of life, plus 5 days of life after death. I hear honking. The sound is far away, and it fades almost as soon as it begins, a low wail through the night as someone speeding by leans on the horn. I'm closer to the road than I thought. I scramble to my feet and go as quickly as I can toward the source of the sound, keeping my arms outstretched like a mummy, slapping away branches and the slick touch of the evergreens. My heart is pounding with excitement, and I strain for a noise, any other noise, to guide me. After a minute or so, I hear another honk, this one closer. I could sob with relief. Another minute, and I hear the thudding bass of a stereo system, tuning in and then out again as a car speeds away. Another minute, and I can see, faintly through the trees, the glimmer of the light from the street lamps. I've found the road. As the lights get closer and the trees thin, I can see a little better, and I start booking it. I'm so busy fantasizing about piles and piles of blankets, I'll take every single one I can find in the house, and hot chocolate and warm slippers and showers, that I don't see Juliet Sykes until the last minute when I nearly trip over her. She's huddled 7 or 8 feet from the road, her arms wrapped around her knees. Water has turned her white top totally transparent, and I can see her bra, striped, and all the bones of her spine. I'm so surprised to come across her like that, I forget, momentarily, that she's the whole reason I'm out here in the first place. "What are you doing?" I say, loudly over the rain. She looks up at me. The street lamps light up her face. Her eyes are dull.
"What are you doing?"
she parrots back at me. I'm looking for you, actually. Her face doesn't register any emotion, no surprise, no shock, no anger, nothing. It throws me. "Aren't you cold?" She shakes her head, just barely, and keeps staring at me with those dull, tired eyes. This isn't nearly how I pictured it would be. I thought she would be happy that I've come to look for her, grateful, even. Or maybe she would be mad. In any case, I thought she would be something. "Listen, Juliet," I can hardly talk, my teeth are chattering so badly. "It's like almost 1 o'clock in the morning, and it's freezing out here. Do you maybe want to come over to my house for a bit and talk? I know what happened in there." I nod back in the direction of Kent's house, and I feel really bad about it. I just want to get her in the damn car. But it's true, I do feel bad. Juliet stares at me for a long, hard second, the rain blurring the few feet between us. She starts to stand, and I feel sure that's done it. But instead, she turns away and takes several steps toward the road.
"Sorry," she says.
Her voice isn't apologetic, though, it's flat. I reach out and grab her wrist. It feels impossibly tiny in my hand, like this one time I found a baby bird near Goose Point, and I picked it up and it died there, taking its final gasping, fluttering breaths in my palm. Juliet doesn't pull away, but she stares at my hand like it's a snake about to bite her. "Listen," I try again, "listen, I know this is going to sound crazy, but..." The wind rushes through the trees and releases a new volley of rain. "I have a feeling that we have something in common, you and me, if we could just go somewhere and talk about it. I'm not going anywhere, Juliet says. She stares out at the road, and I think I see a small, sad smile playing on her lips. Then it's gone. I've been outside too long. My mind is grinding to a halt. Nothing's making sense anymore. Weird images keep flashing through my head, a bizarre fantasy reel of warm things, a pool filled with steaming hot chocolate, a stack of blankets piled all the way to the roof of my house. And part of me just thinks, screw it. Let her do what she's gonna do. Tomorrow, there will be a big rewind anyway. But there's a bigger part of me, my inner bull, my mom used to call it, that says she owes me this. I'm covered in mud, I'm absolutely freezing, and half the population of Thomas Jefferson thinks I'm a pajama-wearing freak. How about we go to your house? I figure she'll have to go back there eventually. She gives me a strange look, and for a second I feel like she's staring straight through me. Why are you doing this? She says. I have to yell even louder than before. Cars are starting to pull out of Kent's driveway, zooming by us on the wet road. I want to help you. She shakes her head, an infinitesimal gesture. You hate me. She's edging closer and closer to the road, and it's making me extremely nervous. A car roars by us, bass pumping. It glitters when it passes under the street lamp, and I can just make out the silhouette of someone laughing. Somewhere to my right, I think I hear my name, but it's hard to tell over the pounding rain. I don't hate you. I don't know you. But I'd like to change that. Start over. I'm almost screaming now. I'm not sure if she can still hear me. She says something I don't hear. Another car goes flashing by, a silver bullet. What? Juliet turns her head a fraction of an inch and says louder, You're right. You don't know me. Another car. Laughter rings out as it passes. Someone throws a beer bottle into the woods and it shatters. Then I'm sure I hear someone calling my name, though I can't tell exactly which direction it comes from. The wind shrieks and I suddenly realize that Juliet's only a half inch from the road, teetering on the thin line where the pavement begins, like she's balancing on a tightrope. Maybe you should come away from the road, I say. But all the time in the back of my head, there's an idea growing and swelling, a horrible, sickening realization, massing up and taking shape like clouds on the horizon. Someone calls my name again, and then, still in the distance, I hear the throaty wail of Splinter by Fallacy pumping from someone's car. Sam! Sam! I recognize it as Kent's voice now. Last night, for the last time, you said you would be mine again. Juliet turns to face me then. She's smiling, but it's the saddest smile I've ever seen. Maybe next time, she says. But probably not. Juliet, I try to say, but the name catches in my throat. I feel like fear has turned me to stone. I want to say something, to move, to reach out and grab her, but time goes so quickly, and then the realization bursts and explodes as the music from the speakers gets louder and a silver Range Rover rockets out of the darkness. Like a bird or an angel, like she's throwing herself off a cliff, Juliet lifts her arms and hurtles onto the road, and there's a scream piercing the air and a sickening crunch, and it's not until Juliet's body flies sideways off the hood of Lindsay's car and lands crumpled face down in the road, and the Range Rover sails into the woods and crashes, splintering, crumpling against a tree, and long ribbons of smoke and flame begin licking the air, that I realize I'm the one screaming. Before I wake, Kent catches up to me then. Sam, he says breathlessly, eyes searching my face. Are you okay? Lindsay, I whisper. It's the only thing that I can think to say. Lindsay and Elodie and Allie are in that car. He turns to the road. Black pillars of smoke are rising out of the woods. From where we're standing, we can just see the battered metal bumper rising like a finger over the dip of the earth. Wait here, he says. It's a miracle, but he sounds calm. He runs into the road, whipping his phone out, and I hear him yelling directions to someone on the other end.
There's been an accident! Fire! Route 9, just past Devon Drive!
He kneels by Juliet's body.
At least one person hurt.
Other cars are squealing to a halt now. People climb out of their cars uncertainly, everyone suddenly sober, everyone speaking in whispers, staring at the tiny, crumpled body in the road, at the smoke and fire licking up from the woods. Emma McElroy pulls over and gets out with her hands cupped over her mouth, eyes bugging out of her head, leaving the door to her Mini hanging open and the radio blasting. Jay-Z's 99 Problems booms through the night, and the normalcy of it is the most horrible thing of all. Someone shrieks, "For God's sake, Emma, shut that off!" Emma scrambles back to her car, and then there's silence, except for the pounding of the rain and the sounds of someone sobbing loudly. I feel like I'm in a dream. I keep trying to move, but I can't. I don't even feel the rain anymore. I don't feel my body. There's only one thought revolving around and around and around in my head. The flash of white just before we pinwheeled into the yawning mouth of the woods. Lindsay yelling something I couldn't quite make out. Not sit. Or shit. Or sight. Sykes. Then a long, piercing wail comes from the other side of the woods, and Lindsay stumbles up to the road, her mouth open and tears streaming down her face. Kent is there supporting Allie, who's limping and coughing but looks okay. Lindsay's screaming, "Help! Help! Elodie's still in there! Somebody help her, please!" She's so hysterical, her words swell together, transforming into an animal howl. She sinks down on the pavement and sobs, her head in her hands. Then another wailing joins in. Sirens in the distance. Nobody moves. Everything starts happening in short, choppy bursts. At least, that's what it seems like to me. Like I'm watching a movie while a strobe light goes on and off. More and more students massing in the rain, standing as still and silent as statues. The police sirens turning, lighting the scene up red, then white, then red, then white. Figures in uniform, an ambulance, a stretcher, two stretchers. Juliet's body laid out neatly, tiny and fragile, just like the bird all those years ago. Lindsay throwing up as the second stretcher bears a body up from the totaled car, and Kent rubbing her back. Allie sobbing with her mouth open, which is weird because I don't hear a sound. At some point, I lift my eyes to the sky and see that the rain has transformed into snow, fat, white flakes swirling out of the darkness as if by magic. I have no idea how long I've been standing there. I'm surprised to see that when I look back at the road, there's hardly anyone left there at all. Just a few stragglers and a solitary police car and Kent, jumping up and down to keep warm, talking to an officer. The ambulances are gone. Lindsay's gone. Allie's gone. Then Kent's standing in front of me, though I didn't see him move. "How did you do that?" I tried to say, but nothing comes out.
"Sam."
Kent's speaking to me, and I get the feeling he said my name more than once. I feel a squeezing sensation, and it takes me a second to realize he has his hands on my arms. It takes me a second to realize I still have arms. And in that moment, it's like I slam back into my body and the force of everything I've seen hits me and my legs buckle and I slump forward. Kent catches me, holds me up.
"What happened?"
I whisper, dazed.
"Is Elodie? Is Juliet?"
"Shh."
His lips are close to my ear.
"You're freezing."
"I have to go find Lindsay."
"You've been out here for over an hour. Your hands are like ice."
He shrugs out of the heavy sweater he's wearing and drapes it over me. There are white snowflakes caught in his lashes. He places his hands gently under my elbows and steers me back toward the driveway.
"Come on, let's get you warm."
I don't have the strength to argue. I let him lead me to the house. His hands never leave me, and even though he's barely grazing my back, I feel like without him I would fall. It seems like we're back at Kent's house without even moving. Then we're in the kitchen and he's pulling out a chair and putting me in it. His lips are moving and his tone is comforting, but I can't understand what he's saying. Then there's a thick blanket over my shoulders and a shooting pain in my fingers and toes as the feeling comes back to them as though someone's sticking hot, sharp needles in me. Still, I can't stop shivering. My teeth are clacking together with a noise like dice rattling in a cup. The kegs are still in the corner, and there are half-empty cups everywhere and cigarette butts swimming in them, but the music's off, and the house feels totally different without any people in it. My mind is focusing on a bunch of tiny details, ricocheting from one to the other like a ping-pong ball. The embroidered sign above the sink that says, "Martha Stewart does not live here." The snapshots posted on the refrigerator of Kent and his family on the beach somewhere, of relatives, I don't know, of old postcards from Paris, Morocco, San Francisco, rows of mugs displayed behind the glass cabinets with slogans on them like "caffeine or bust" and "it's tea time."
"One marshmallow or two," Kent is saying.
"What?" My voice comes out croaky and weird. All my other senses come online in a rush. I hear the hissing of milk heating in a pot. Kent's face comes into focus, sweet and concerned, bits of snow melting out of his shaggy brown hair. The blanket around my shoulders smells like lavender.
"I'll just put in a couple," Kent says,
turning back to the stove. In a minute, there's an oversized mug. This one says, "Home is where the chocolate is," steaming in front of me, filled with foamy hot chocolate. The real kind, not the kind you get from a package. And big, bobbing marshmallows. I don't know whether I've asked for this out loud or whether he's just read my mind. Kent sits across from me at the table and watches me take a sip. It's delicious. Just sweet enough and full of cinnamon and something else I can't identify, and I put the mug down with slightly steadier hands. "Where's Lindsay?" I say, as the scene comes back to me. Lindsay on her knees in front of everyone, throwing up. She must have been out of her mind. Lindsay would never do something like that in public. "Is she okay?" Kent nods, his eyes fixed on my face.
"Lindsay's fine. She had to go to the hospital to be checked out for shock and stuff, but she's going to be okay."
Juliet came so fast. I close my eyes, envisioning the white blur, and when I open them, Kent looks like his insides are getting torn out. Is Juliet? He shakes his head once.
"There was nothing they could do," he says.
So quietly, if I didn't know what he was going to say, I would never have heard him. "I saw her." I start to speak and find I can't. "I could have grabbed her. She was so close."
"It was an accident."
Kent looks down. I'm not sure whether he really believes it. "No, it wasn't," I want to say. I think of her strange half-smile as she said,
"Maybe next time. But probably not,"
and close my eyes, willing the memory away. "What about Allie? Is she okay?"
"Allie's fine. Not even a scratch."
Kent's voice gets stronger, but there's a pleading sound to it, and I understand he's trying to get me to stop talking. He doesn't want me to ask what I'm about to ask. "Elodie?" My voice comes out in a whisper. Kent looks away, a muscle works in his jaw.
"She was sitting in the front seat,"
he says finally, as though each and every word hurts. And I think of Elodie leaning forward and whining. "Why does Sam always get shotgun?"
"The passenger side took most of the impact."
I wonder if that's how they would have explained it to my parents at the hospital. Collision, passenger side, impact. "Is she?" I can't say the word. He looks at me like he's about to cry. He looks older than I've ever seen him, his eyes dark and full and sad.
"I'm so sorry, Sam," he says quietly.
"What are you telling me?"
I ball my fists up so tightly I can feel my nails dig into my skin.
"Are you saying that she's...
I break off, still unable to say it. Saying it will make it real. Kent looks like each word is something sharp he has to bring up from his stomach.
It would have been instant.
Painless.
Painless?
I repeat, my voice shaking.
Painless? You don't know that. You can't know that.
There's a fist in my throat.
Is that what they said? They said it was painless. Like it was peaceful. Like it was okay.
Kent reaches for my hand across the table.
Sam, no!
I scrape my chair back from the table and stand up. My whole body is vibrating with rage.
No! Don't tell me it's going to be okay. Don't tell me it didn't hurt her. You don't know. You have no idea. None of you have any idea how much it hurts. It hurts.
I'm not even sure whether I'm talking about Elodie or myself. Kent stands up and wraps his arms around me. I find myself with my head buried in his shoulder, sobbing. He keeps me pressed tightly to him, and he's making little noises into my hair, and before I totally let go of everything and succumb to the blackness washing through me, I have the strangest, dumbest thought that my head fits perfectly in Kent's shoulder. Then the thought of Elodie and Juliet becomes too much, and a heavy veil drops down over my mind, and I cry. It's the second night in a row I've totally lost it in front of Kent, though. Of course, he couldn't know that. I should be grateful he doesn't remember that only last night we sat together in a dark room with our knees almost touching. But instead, it makes me feel even more alone. I'm lost in a fog, in a mist. And at some point, when I start to come back to myself, I realize that Kent is literally holding me up. My feet are barely skimming the ground. His mouth is buried in my hair, and I feel his breath close to my ear. A zip of electricity goes through me, which makes me feel awful and more confused than ever. I pull away, putting a little bit of space between us. He keeps his arms on either side of mine, though, bracing me, and I'm glad. He's solid and warm.
You're still freezing, he says.
He puts the back of his hand against my cheek for 1 millisecond, but when he pulls away, I can feel the outline of his hand like it's scalded me.
Your clothes are soaking.
Underwear, I blurt out. He wrinkles his forehead.
What?
My pants and fleece and underwear, it's all full of snow. Well, mostly melted water now. It's really cold. I'm too exhausted to care about being embarrassed. Kent just bites his lip and nods.
Stay here, he says, and drink up.
He nods to the hot chocolate. He guides me back into the chair and disappears. I'm still shivering, but at least I can hold the mug without slopping it all over the table. I don't think about anything but the motion of the mug to my lips and the taste of the cocoa, the ticking of a cat-tailed clock, and the drifting white outside the windows. In a few seconds, Kent's back with an enormous fleece, faded sweatpants, and folded striped boxers.
They're mine, he says, and then turns bright red. Not mine. I didn't wear them yet or anything. My mom bought them for me.
He catches himself and swallows.
I bought them for myself, like Tuesday. Tag's still on and everything.
Kent? I interrupt him. He sucks in a breath.
Yeah?
I'm really sorry, but do you mind being quiet? I gesture to my head. My brain is full of fuzz.
I'm sorry, he exhales. I don't know what to do. I wish that there was more.
Thanks, I say. I know he's making an effort, and I manage a weak smile. He lays the clothes down on the table along with a big, fluffy white towel.
I didn't know. I thought if you were still cold, you could take a shower.
He blushes at the word shower. I shake my head. I really just want to sleep. I've forgotten about sleep, and I feel a huge lift when I say it. All I have to do is sleep. As soon as I fall asleep, this nightmare will be over. Still, A twittering feeling of anxiety rises up inside me. What if the day doesn't rewind this time? What if this is it? I think of Elodie and feel the hot chocolate coming back up in my throat. Kent must see the expression on my face because he crouches down so we're at eye level. Can I do anything? Can I get you anything? I shake my head, trying not to cry again. I'll be okay. It's just the shock. I swallow hard. I want to rewind, you know? He nods once and puts his hand over mine. I don't pull it away. If I could make it better, I would, he says. In some ways, it's a stupid, obvious thing to say, but the way he says it, so honest and simple, like it's the truest thing there is, makes tears prick in my eyes. I take the clothes and the towel and go out into the hall to the bathroom we broke into to find Juliet. I go in and shut the door. The window's still open and flurries of snow whirl in from outside. I shut the window. It makes me feel better already, like I'm already starting the process of erasing everything that's happened tonight. Elodie will be fine. After all, I was the one who was supposed to be in the front seat. I hang the hand towel Juliet left by the sink and strip out of my clothes, shaking. The shower is too hard to resist, after all, and I turn the water on as high and as hot as it can go and get in. It's one of those rainforest showers where the water pours on you straight from above in a long, heavy stream. When it hits the marble tiles under my feet, it lets up big clouds of steam. I stay in the shower so long my skin gets pruney. I put on Kent's fleece, which is super soft and smells like laundry detergent and, for some reason, freshly mowed grass. Then I snap the tags off the boxers and slip my legs into them. They're too big on me, obviously, but I like how clean and crisp they feel on my skin. The only other boxers I've seen are Rob's, usually crumpled up on his floor or shoved under his bed and stained with things I have no desire to identify. Last, I put on the sweatpants, which pool over my feet. Kent has given me socks, too, the big, fluffy kind. I ball up all of my clothes and leave them just outside the bathroom door. When I go back in the kitchen, Kent's standing there exactly as I left him. Something flickers in his eyes when I come in, but I'm not sure what it is.
Your hair's wet, he says softly, but he says it like he's actually saying something else.
I look down. I showered, after all. Silence stretches between us for a few beats. Then he says,
You're tired. I'll drive you home.
No. I say it more forcefully than I meant to, and Kent looks startled. No, I mean, I can't. I don't want to go home right now.
Your parents,
Kent trails off. Please. I don't know which would be worse. If my parents have already heard and are sitting there waiting for me, waiting to grill me and ask me questions and talk about hospitals in the morning and therapists to help me deal, or if they haven't heard yet and I come home to a dark house.
There's a guest room here, Kent says.
His hair is finally drying into little wisps and waves. No guest rooms, I shake my head resolutely. I want to be in a room, a lived-in room. Kent stares at me for a second and then says, Come with me. He reaches for my hand as he passes and I let him take it. We go up the stairs and down the hall and to the bedroom with all the bumper stickers on it. I should have known it was his. He fiddles with the door. It sticks, he explains, and finally pops it open. I inhale sharply. The smell is just the same as it was last night when I was here with Rob, but everything is different. The darkness looks softer, somehow.
Give me a second.
Kent squeezes my hand and pulls away. I hear the rustling of the curtains and I gasp. Suddenly, three enormous windows, stretching from floor to ceiling and taking up one entire wall, are revealed. He hasn't turned on a light, but he may as well have. The moon is huge and luminous and bounces through all the dazzling white snow, growing brighter. The whole room is bathed in a beautiful silver light. It's amazing, I say. I breathe out. I didn't even realize I was holding my breath. Kent smiles quickly. His face is silhouetted in moonlight.
It's great at night. Not so great at sunrise, though.
He starts to draw the curtains closed. Leave them open! I cry out and then add, please. I suddenly feel shy. Kent's room is enormous and smells like that same incredible mixture of downy laundry detergent and grass shavings. It's the freshest smell in the world, the smell of open windows and crisp sheets. Last night I couldn't make out anything but the bed. Now I see the room is lined completely with bookshelves. There's a desk in the corner stacked with a computer and more books. There are pictures framed on the walls, blurred figures moving, but I can't make out the details. A monster beanbag chair squats in one corner and Kent catches me staring at it.
I've had it since 7th grade, he says.
He sounds embarrassed. I used to have one like that, I say.
I don't add why I chucked it, because Lindsay said it looked like a lumpy boob.
I can't think about Lindsay now, or Allie. I definitely can't think about Elodie. Kent draws the blankets down on his bed and then stands back, turning away so I have some privacy. I climb into the bed and lie down, my limbs heavy and achingly stiff, feeling a little self-conscious but so numb with exhaustion, I don't care. There's a curved wooden headboard and a matching footboard, and as soon as I'm stretched out, I'm reminded of being in a sleigh. I tilt my head so I can see the snow drifting down and then close my eyes, imagining that I'm flying through a forest on my way to somewhere good. A trim little white house in the distance, candles burning in its windows.
Good night,
Kent whispers. He's so quiet I'd forgotten he was standing there. I snap my eyes open and sit up on one elbow. Kent?
Yeah?
Can you maybe stay with me a bit? He nods and rolls the desk chair over to the side of the bed without speaking. He tucks his knees up to his chin and looks at me. The moonlight coming in through the windows turns his hair a soft silver. Kent?
Yeah?
Do you think it's weird that I'm here with you? I close my eyes when I say it so I don't have to look at his face.
I'm the editor-in-chief of the Tribulation, he says. And I once went 365 days wearing Crocs. I don't think anything's weird.
I forgot about the Crocs phase, I say. I'm finally warm under the covers and I feel sleep creeping up on me like I'm standing on a hot beach with a gentle tide pulling at my toes. Kent?
Yeah?
Why are you being so nice to me? There's quiet for so long, I begin to think he won't answer. I imagine I can hear the snow drifting to earth, covering over the day, erasing it clean. I'm too frightened to open my eyes, terrified that I'll break the spell, terrified he'll look angry or hurt.
Remember the time in 2nd grade, right after my grandfather died?
He says finally, speaking in a low, quiet voice.
I burst into tears in the lunchroom, and Phil Howell called me a faggot. That only made me cry harder, even though I didn't know what a faggot was.
He laughs softly. I keep my eyes squeezed shut, coasting on his voice. Last year, Phil Howell was found half-naked with Sean Treiber in the back of his dad's BMW. It's funny how things turn out.
Anyway, when I told him to leave me alone, he smacked my tray, and food went flying everywhere. I'll never forget. We were having mashed potatoes and turkey burgers, and you went up and scooped the potatoes off the floor with your hands and shoved them straight into Phil's face. Then you picked up the turkey burger and crumbled it down Phil's t-shirt. You said, "You're worse than a hot lunch."
He laughs again.
That was a big insult in 2nd grade. And Sean was so surprised, and he looked so ridiculous standing there with mashed potatoes and chives smeared all over him that I just started laughing, and it was the first time I'd laughed since I heard the news about my grandfather.
He pauses.
Do you remember what I said to you that day?
The memory is there, a balloon swelling from somewhere so far inside me I thought it was lost. The whole scene clear and perfect now. You're my hero. we both say at the same time. I don't hear Kent move, but all of a sudden his voice is closer and he's found my hands in the dark, and he's cupping them in his.
I vowed, after that day, that I would be your hero too. No matter how long it took, he whispers.
We stay like that for what feels like hours, and all the time sleep is dragging at me, pulling me away from him, but my heart is fluttering like a moth, beating back the dreams and the darkness and the fog crowding my brain. Once I sleep, I lose him. I lose this moment forever. Kent, I say, and my voice seems to have to rise from inside the fog, taking forever to get from my brain to my mouth.
Yeah?
Promise you'll stay here with me? I say.
I promise, he whispers.
And then, just at that moment, when I'm no longer sure if I'm dreaming or awake or walking some valley in between where everything you wish for comes true, I feel the flutter of his lips on mine. But it's too late. I'm slipping, I'm gone, he's gone, and the moment curls away and back on itself like a flower folding up for the night.